characteristic of elite culture in Russia at the time. He reveled in the imagination, reveled in the creative forms of writing, and occasionally not only poetry, but prose. This was, in fact, essential to the pleasure people found in reading him, essential to his popularity, central to the culture of his time. Which isn't to say this wasn't serious play. Pushkin worked hard in his writings. He tried to make them look brilliant and easy. Again, to some degree, this was a pose. It's clear because his manuscripts so show careful crafting, much rewriting. Now, it has to be said that many literate Russians were beginning to get tired of Pushkin's virtuosity and Protean style. Already in 1825, there were some complaints that he wasn't sufficiently high-minded, not serious enough. And in fact, by the early 1830s, one begins to see a decline in sales of his books. It seems in some ways Pushkin was becoming passé. And then he died, suddenly and tragically. By 1836, his situation had in fact become increasingly difficult, some would say desperate. His popularity as an author was waning. His debts from gambling were growing. And there were continuing problems with the Tsar, and in particular with the official given charge of censoring all his works. And finally, insult was added to injury. And rumors came to him about a flirtation, or worse, between his wife and a rather good-looking young cavalry officer named Georges Danté, a French émigré who was the adopted son of the Dutch ambassador to Russia. On top of that, he receives a letter, while already worrying about this flirtation with Danté, that suggests that there was a liaison between his wife and the Tsar himself. Remember, this isn't out of the question. His wife was the greatest beauty of Petersburg. The Tsar was considered one of the most handsome and dashing men in the city, not to mention the most powerful. Pushkin decided to challenge Danté to a duel. And they almost fought until Danté agreed to settle the matter by marrying Pushkin's sister-in-law, his wife's sister, who was also quite good-looking. And Pushkin agreed at that point to back down, that this settled it, there would be no more flirtation. But this didn't stop either of them, either Pushkin or Danté. Danté, in fact, continued increasingly visibly to flirt with Pushkin's wife, who was now his own sister-in-law. So Pushkin at this point wrote to Danté's father, the Dutch ambassador, remember, a letter that was so crude and insulting that when young Danté saw this letter, he really felt he had no choice, given the rules of honor of the day, than to challenge Pushkin to a duel. They fought on January 27th, 1837. The chosen weapons were pistols in a grove on the northern outskirts of St. Petersburg, a grove that has the rather ominous name of Black Stream, Chorlia Rechka. Pushkin lost and died 2 days later after great suffering from his injuries. Death transformed his image. It truly reminded people of what they had lost, their best writer, a sign in some ways of how mature Russian literature had become, how it had mastered and even gone beyond, many felt, European style, how original it had finally become. Contemporaries recalled at the time that all Petersburg was talking about Pushkin. His waning popularity was suddenly replaced with new enthusiasm. And when his body lay in state in his apartment in the city, thousands of people came to pay their final respects. Some reports said that people tore bits off his clothing while he lay there, and then women even came along and cut bits of pieces off his hair, relics of the great Pushkin. His books, of course, began to sell out immediately, and the printers could hardly keep up. And government reports expressed open fear this whole thing might turn into a massive political demonstration. Nothing like this outpouring of emotion for a poet or any non-government official had ever taken place in Russian history before. In fact, this really was, as the government feared, a type of movement of society, something still very frightening to the state, especially to Nicholas I. In fact, the gendarme chief described the whole thing as, in his words, an indecent tableau of the triumph of the liberals. This was, in other words, in many ways, a powerful moment in Russian history when Russian citizens were saying, "We exist as Russians because of our common love of a great writer, because of what we share culturally, and emotionally, not because we are simply subjects of the Tsar. Very hard to describe these feelings, but everybody understood something important was expressed in the feelings about Pushkin now that he died. Now, the state, the government, gave warnings to newspapers, please do not make too much of all of this thing, and certainly not of Pushkin. But a few newspapers managed to do so anyway and had to be reprimanded after the fact. For example, this obituary appeared in the literary supplement of one St. Petersburg paper. I quote a bit of it. The sun of our poetry has set. Pushkin has passed away. Every Russian heart knows the irreparable loss, and every Russian heart is torn to pieces. Pushkin, our poet, our joy, our national glory. These were the first indications of a cult of Pushkin as a national symbol that would continue to grow. In fact, already before he died, there began to be something like this, a hint of the type of cult of Pushkin that would emerge. One writer, Nikolai Gogol, also a well-known writer at the time, began to already describe Pushkin as a national poet. For example, he wrote in 1834, Pushkin's name calls to mind the thought of a Russian national poet. He's the manifestation of the Russian spirit. In him, the Russian nature, the Russian soul, the Russian language, the Russian character are reflected with the same purified beauty in which a landscape is reflected on the convex surface of optical glass. His life is absolutely Russian. Pushkin's death made such arguments even more compelling. And the high point of all this came in 1880, some years later, but part of a growing movement of seeing Pushkin as their national poet, when there was a huge three-day celebration organized around the unveiling of a great new monument to Pushkin that would sit at the heart of Moscow. This was also significantly the first major monument in Russia that was not dedicated to a political or military leader. It was built with public initiative and public funds. This was in many ways a civic act by society itself. At the unveiling, Fyodor Dostoevsky, another great writer, caught the spirit of the moment and was greeted with what observers described as wails of rapture in his speech. He declared, Pushkin was the most Russian of all Russians in his ability to express the spirit of any nation he chose. He was the universal man, and as such, the most Russian. His voice, Dostoevsky said, had the unique power to reconcile all of Europeans' conflicts once and for all, to show the way out of European ennui in our universally human and unifying Russian soul. Dostoevsky later wrote to his wife that people were absolutely torn apart about this speech. The crowd was in hysterics. People were weeping and hugging one another and promising to be better people forever. In Soviet times, and now in post-Soviet times as well, Pushkin's repeatedly been described as symbolizing everything that's great in Russia, everything that Russia is. And for good measure, of course, his name has been fixed into physical spaces all over the country. His name is attached to cities. There's a city called Pushkin. To libraries. Everywhere there are Pushkin libraries. Schools are named after him. Streets are named after him. Squares. Even steamships are named Pushkin. But what does Pushkin symbolize to all of these people? Obviously, I would suggest, he is a complex symbol, like Russian culture itself. On the one hand, he seems to be a symbol of true Russianness. And as such, he's often claimed by nationalists, characterist of the very Russianness of being unique and different from the rest of the world. This was most visible, it was said, in his language, which could never be translated. You had to read Russian fluently to really see what was great about Pushkin. He was something unique. But also one sees in Pushkin and the way people talked about Pushkin as the entwining of Russian culture with other cultures, especially European culture. It's cosmopolitan character, in other words, the way in which Pushkin embraced world literature. Russianness and cosmopolitanism were both entwined in the meaning of Pushkin to so many people. Pushkin was also a symbol of true love of country, loyalty to the state. He was certainly claimed this way by the Russian state and the Soviet state later, but it's clear in his poems. He deeply loves the landscapes of Russia. the heroes of Russian history, the unusual people, even its gypsies, everything about the country he expresses great love for. But he also is a symbol of rebellion against Russia, even of a desire to leave the country. And indeed, many dissidents have noted just this part about him that they most love. He understood what was wrong with Russia. We see him also as a poet who was admired because of his seriousness, his earnestness, but also his playfulness. And of course, ultimately, people often saw in Pushkin what they wanted to see. And I think that's in this ambivalence, this contradictoriness about the story of Pushkin as so many saw him, that one sees Russia most clearly, the shape of its history, of its life in so many ways. Of course, Pushkin was not alone in defining what Russia meant. Next time, we'll look at other individuals who also expressed different definitions of what Russianness meant, who made different efforts to try to answer that key question of what the Russian nation was, what its future should be.
Lecture 11, The Birth of the Intelligentsia.
The emergence of the intelligentsia in Russia was really one of the most important developments in the 19th century and is the subject of this lecture and the one following it. In many ways, we've already seen the first steps in the emergence of this group of individuals with people like Novikov and the Decembrists. But it was really only after the Decembrists, and partly because of them, that one could speak of a full-fledged movement of dissident intellectuals in Russia. In fact, by the mid-19th century, their presence and their ideas were becoming increasingly visible and increasingly important in shaping the way people, at least educated people, began to talk about the meaning of Russia and its fate. One needs to first pause a little more than I've done in the past over this very notion, this word, intelligentsia, for it has a particular meaning in the Russian context. Well, I've hinted at this. Most important, it's worth keeping in mind that an intelligentsia, at least it was understood in 19th century Russia, was not a social category. It wasn't a class or an occupational group. It was a cultural category. It wasn't just any educated person, though it assumes education. It didn't include all professionals, an important class that's growing in Russia at this time. To be sure, there were many professors and writers and others who were members of the intelligentsia, but not all were intelligenti, to use the plural of the singular word for an individual member of the intelligentsia, an intelligent in Russian. It was also not determined, membership in this intelligentsia, by social origins. Nobles and members of the middle class could be in it, but many nobles and middle class people were not. There would in fact even be a peasant intelligentsia eventually, a worker intelligentsia. It didn't even just include all people who had an interest in ideas, which is in many ways our Western usage of this term. Members of the intelligentsia, by the Russian 19th century standard, were people defined by a particular way of looking at the world, by their social and political and aesthetic and especially moral outlooks. In other words, by their culture. A few generalizations about this culture. First of all, this was a set of people who were defined by their opposition to a repressive and restrictive political and social order. This is absolutely essential, the sense of critical opposition. It was also a dissent based on principles. The intelligenti saw themselves as fighting, not for themselves, not for their own particular social interests, but for other people, for the nation, for common people, and most importantly, for ideas, for principles. And although ideas were central, the intelligentsia was also defined, above all, by its spirit. They saw ideas as not just ideas, but as sacred, as absolutely universal, transcending space and time. They saw their activities as something about saving Russia, saving the world, as a type of mission. They saw their lives, in many ways, as a consecration to this higher cause of justice and of ideals. One might, as some people have said, describe the intelligentsia as a type of secular priesthood with a sort of religious commitment to transforming the world around them. A classic example of this spirit of the intelligentsia that helps define it can be found in the life of one of the most famous and influential of these Russian intelligentsia, a man named Alexander Herzen, like most intelligentsia, but not all, coming from a well-educated noble family. He himself got an excellent education at home and then studied at the University of Moscow. And in 1826, as a boy of 14, he was born in 1812, he was taken to a religious service at the Kremlin, where just the very high elite were invited. And this service was to mark the execution by hanging of the five Decembrist leaders, all young, educated members of the nobility, like many of the people who were present. The royal family was entirely there, including the emperor. The Senate was there. The elite guards troops were present. The Metropolitan of Moscow led the service. Cannons thundered overhead. Never, Herzen said, remembering this moment, have, in his words, the gallows been celebrated with such pomp. And he described his inward reaction to this event. There, on the spot, before that altar defiled by bloody rites, I swore to avenge the murdered men and dedicated myself to the struggle with that throne, with that altar, with those cannon. In fact, in the life of many intelligentsia, we find these similar moments of a conversion, consecration to the cause, essential to the spirit and the definition of the intelligentsia. Now, historically, the key period in which one really sees the emergence of this group of critically minded, dissident, educated Russians was the 1830s and the 1840s, time of Nicholas I. This was also a time in which this intelligentsia, at its very birth, and this would last throughout its history, split into two major currents. One of them was called Westernizers, or Zapadniki in Russian, and the others Slavophiles, Slavyanophili. Terms, by the way, which were not used by themselves. They were coined by each other. They were meant to be slightly mocking and exaggerated, and therefore one should be cautious in reading too much into those as accurate descriptions of these movements. But they're telling, as you'll see. There are, in fact, real differences between these groups, and I'll be discussing these differences in a moment. But these differences should not be overstated, should not be exaggerated. For one thing, they all knew each other personally. They liked each other. They were mainly from the same small social class. At this point, the intelligentsia was primarily from the nobles, though not all. And they were indeed educated noblemen, mainly young. And they were friends. They visited one another. They ate together. They drank together. They went to each other's salons and circles and weddings. They argued together. They were part of the same group of people in Moscow and Petersburg mostly. Most importantly, though, they shared certain essential beliefs, certain essential values, a certain outlook and sensibility, what one might call a romantic group culture. And two points about this. First of all, they shared a common philosophical outlook. Westernizers and Slavophiles both were deeply influenced by German romantic philosophers, especially Schelling and Hegel. And German philosophy, which they all read, and usually in the original German, taught educated Russians many different things. But I want to emphasize one because it really is the most essential for thinking about this shared philosophical outlook. For the German idealists, who they greatly admired, the 18th century rationalists were wrong to view the world in mechanical terms, as separate elements that fit together in some rational manner, that fit together functionally, like a clock. A favorite metaphor in the 18th century of rationalists. Rather, they said, the German idealists said, the world is organic, it's whole. And to understand the world, one has to understand not how it works, that's the sort of rationalist approach, but its inner essence, its spirit, its purpose, what it is in its very nature. Or to use their own language, One needed to seek the manifestations of the absolute in the world, or the spirit of the world, Geist in German, Duch in Russian, the idea of the time. In other words, truth was to be found not with the help of the tools of mechanical reasoning, but with instinct and emotion, with the senses. All of this is extremely important in the life of the Russian intelligentsia in the 1830s and 40s, really shaped how they approached the world in many ways. First of all, this meant discovering where oneself fit into the grand unified scheme of things, one's calling and purpose in life, how one felt fit in to the absolute, to the spirit of the age. It's really hard to exaggerate how important this was to them. Think of Herzen swearing to avenge the murdered Decembrists by fighting autocracy. He had found a place for himself in the grand cosmos of things. Secondly, it meant discovering what Russia's place was in this great totality. What was Russia's calling, its purpose, its mission? We saw early signs of this already in the Decembrists, and their sensibility becomes much more intense by the 1830s. Second point about this romantic group culture shared by Westernizers and Slavophiles alike is both shared a sort of romantic style, a romantic temperament. Partly this meant not to ever be jaded and aloof, not to be sort of cool and aristocratic like many ordinary upper-class youths in Russia. On the contrary, you were expected to be passionate, emotional, enthusiastic, dreamy even. And you could get excited about a lot of different things, though preferably the more the better. Poetry. You should be excited about poetry, especially if it was highly sentimental. Nature, especially if it was wild and unkempt. Friendship, especially if it was deep and intense and lifelong. And romantic love, with the emphasis on the personal bonds between people. And of course, all these things were said to be expressions of the great absolute, of the greater unity and higher meaning of all things which you could connect to with your soul. Most of all, of course, these young men, and they were at this point mostly men, indeed all men, were fervent about, passionate about ideas. And the more abstract the ideas, the better. They would stay up, in fact, all night arguing about philosophical questions, and these arguments could be extremely serious and be taken very personally. For example, as Herzen, again, who remembers these years so brilliantly in his own memoir, describes these times, he said, "People who adored each other became estranged for entire weeks because they could not agree on the definition of transcendental spirit or were offended by opinions about absolute personality." In 1836, into this really intense, indeed overheated, emotional and intellectual milieu, entered an astonishing little essay. It had a rather unassuming title. It was called The First Philosophical Letter, written by a man named Pyotr Chedayev, who lived from 1794 to 1856. It was written several years earlier, but and existed to some only in manuscript, but really only became known when it was published in 1836 in a Moscow journal by a mistake of the censor, who wasn't reading very closely and didn't understand what it said, for which, by the way, he was fired. It is hard to exaggerate how excited people were and how angry some were when this essay appeared, this letter. Herzen himself recalled that it was like a gunshot in the dead of night. Just stood up starkly after reading it. And he couldn't control his own excitement when he read it and then talked to others about it. Partly this excitement was a response to Chedayev's tone and style. And in this romantic age, style is something these young men were very sensitive to. It was full of bitterness and pain, despair even. Nobody before, at least not in print, had so passionately voiced the anguish about the world around them that many of these emerging intelligentsia felt. Most important, of course, was what Chedayev said. He addressed the question of questions, if you're a romantic. What is Russia's historical nature, and what is its destiny as a nation? And he offered a rather daring and troubling explication of the emptiness of Russia's national culture from a philosophical, romantic point of view. Here's his words. We Russians have come into the world like illegitimate children, without a heritage of our own, without any ties binding us to the men who came before us on this earth. Unlike normal civilizations, which were supposed to develop naturally over time, organically, Russia was like, he said, time's orphan. We are placed, he said, as it were, outside of time. We move so oddly in time that as we advance, the immediate past is irretrievably lost to us. This is a natural consequence of a culture that is wholly importive and imitative. You can hear what he's talking about. There's no internal development, no natural progress in our society. New ideas sweep out old ideas because they're not derived from the old, but come from God knows where. For Chadayev, though, Russia's rather unique position on the boundaries of Asia and Europe gave it something unique. Russians, especially romantic Russians, are always looking for the unique genius of a nation. Gave Russia a unique possibility in the world. As he put it, placed between the two great divisions of the world, between the East and the West, Europe and Asia, resting one elbow on China and the other on Germany, we ought to combine in ourselves the two great principles of human intelligence, imagination and reason, and fuse in our civilization the history of all parts of the globe. Something, remember, Dostoevsky talked about finding in Pushkin. But he said it's not there. Russia's fate was to fail to be either East or West, to be any sort of civilization at all, or even worse, to be original. And every nation has to be original. He says, and I'm reading the words because it's important to feel the tone, because it was so important to people at the time. This is not the role Providence has assigned to us, he said. On the contrary, it has left us entirely to ourselves. We are alone in the world. We have not added a single idea to the sum total of human ideas. We have not contributed to the progress of the human spirit. And what we've borrowed of this progress, we've distorted. Not one useful thought has sprung from the arid soil of our fatherland. Today, say what you will, we are a blank in the intellectual order of things. And his tone became increasingly despairing as he spelled out the implications of all this. He says, look around you. Everybody seems to have one foot in the air. We have nothing that binds, nothing that endures, nothing that remains. This anguished cry by Pyotr Chadayev, one can see, is suffused with the whole spirit of European Romanticism. He would have never written these words without the influence of Romantic philosophy that affected him and so many others around him. And you can see this partly in its tone and style, the passion with which it was written. But one can also see the influence of Romanticism in his substance, especially his preoccupying focus on history, something, as you'll see, that naturally preoccupied all intellectuals, Westernizers, and Slavophiles alike. Like virtually every well-educated Russian, hence the impact of his words, for they're based on these assumptions, Chadayev believed that history defined a nation. A nation evolves organically, naturally, through history. And therefore, for him to say, as he did, that Russia lacked history, is to say that Russia was not a nation. It was a nothing, or in his really horrifying phrase, horrifying to many at his time, Russia was a blank in the intellectual order of things. Now, these arguments provoked different reactions. The government, never very tolerant of dissent at all, declared Chadayev to have gone completely mad and placed him under house arrest to protect this insane man from other people, or other people from him. Most intellectuals read this, remember, it's a gunshot in the middle of the night to Herzen, more thoughtfully, though with intensity. First of all, they said his despair has to be rejected. At least they recognized this was a dead end. It was going to get nowhere. After all, how could they accept the idea that the country that they wanted to, that concerned them so much, whose they wanted to serve in so many ways, had no future, had no mission in the world? What would be the meaning of all their searching, of all their arguments, if Russia was meaningless? Two major arguments came to Chadayev's letter from people who became known precisely for their arguments about Russia in relationship to the rest of the world, who became known as Westernizers and Slavophiles. First, though, before I talk about these responses, it's worth noting Chidiath's own response to himself. In 1837, he wrote a new piece entitled, with some irony, Apology of a Madman, in which he notably retreated from some of his tones of despair, which indeed to him seemed to be getting nowhere. He didn't retreat from his main argument. He says, the history of a people is more than a succession of facts. It's a series of interconnected ideas, and that is precisely the history we do not have. We have to learn, he said, to get along without it, and not vilify the persons who first noticed our lack. Himself, in other words. And he was indeed vilified by many. He also fought against those people who said he was unpatriotic and anti-Russian. He said, believe me, I cherish my country more than any of you critics. But I believe that one can be useful to one's country only if one sees it clearly, very much characteristic of the stance of the intelligentsia. One owes one's country, he said, the truth, not that smug patriotism, that lazy patriotism that manages to make everything beautiful, that falls asleep on its illusions. But now he began to consider Russia's backwardness to be a peculiar sort of advantage, and indeed many others would pick up this idea later. Precisely because Russia had no history, he said, reason, the power of reason, was given a freer hand. Precisely because, he said now, Russia lacked any traditions of its own, Russia could embrace the traditions of a real civilization that had grown naturally, namely Western Europe. And he said, as a result, that there was one important early man who understood this, and that was Peter the Great. And his words you've heard before, he said of Peter, in his hand, Peter the Great found only a blank sheet of paper, and with a strong hand he wrote on it, Europe in the West. Now you can see the context of Chidiath's notion that Russia was a blank sheet of paper, but with will and reason, you could write on it, the West. Europe and the West, I should have said. The Slavophiles were among the fiercest critics of Chidiath. They shared with Chidiath one thing, above all, this romantic view of history as a source of nationhood. Though Chidiath himself began to abandon this in favor of the power of reason, embracing a truly historical civilization. But what the Slavophiles did is see in Russia's past the thing that Chidiath did not see. Not a succession of facts, but, in his words again, a series of interconnected ideas. The Slavophiles said this does exist in Russia. And to demonstrate this, they began studying and collecting Russian folklore, studying popular cultural traditions. Chidiath, by the way, along with many of the Westernizers, was absolutely contemptuous of these sort of ethnographic exercises to discover the culture of the Russian people. As he wrote, from time to time, our fanatic Slavophiles exhume objects of general interest for our museums and libraries. But I doubt that these Slavophiles will ever be able to extract something from our historical soil that can fill the void in our souls or condense the vagueness of our spirit. But this is precisely what the Slavophiles thought they had found. And partly they did this by turning Chidiath's argument on its head. They agreed that some Russians indeed, as Chidiath said, were homeless nomads. But this, he said, only applied to westernized Russians, whose Western education had alienated them from their own culture, had uprooted them from their own real Russian society, from the naturalness that existed in Russia. In ordinary people, they said, those traditions, that nationhood, that natural organic development still existed. And the most important of these traditions, they said, was a communal spirit, a sense of community that had never been lost by the common people of Russia. And they adapt an older theological concept that was already around and called this spirit sobornosts. Sobornost was an older idea. In fact, it comes from the idea of a religious gathering, a religious community. And this idea was at the heart of all Slavophile traditions, all Slavophile thinking about Russia and its future. Usually this word is translated rather obscurely as consularity, because sabor means a type of council. But more importantly, sabornness could be translated as spiritual community, a natural, essential community rooted in the spiritual, not in the sense of religion, though that was part of it, but in terms of a common inward spirit, shared values, a collective psychology. In other words, sabornists, their central ideal was an ideal of a society that existed as a community, united by free will on the basis of shared values and indeed even shared ways of feeling. This idea was most fully elaborated by one particular Slavophile named Alexei Chomyakov. And for Slavophiles like Chomyakov, Russia embodied these values of spiritual community like no other country. It really went to the heart of what Russia was. One reason Russia did so, Russia's nationhood was so imbued with this spiritual community of sabornists, was the particular character of Russian religion, the fact that Russians were Eastern Orthodox, which was seen to nurture this communal spirit with its focus on community and its focus on the ritual process of prayer. Ironically, but significantly, telling us something about Russia at the time, the Orthodox Church completely disagreed with the way Chomyakov and the Slavophiles thought about Orthodoxy. In fact, the Holy Synod, the administrative body that administered the church, declared that the idea of sabornists challenged church authority as an institution, placed too much emphasis on faith, on will, even if it was a collective faith and will, and too little emphasis on the institutions and structures of the church. So they forbid Chomyakov's writings about sabornists, and ironically, this Slavophile had to publish these ideas about the true nature of Russia in Western Europe. And in a way, the Synod was right. The Slavophiles did see Orthodoxy as a free community of believers. Freedom was essential. Choice was essential. There could not be compulsion. Otherwise, how could it be a natural community? The Slavophiles also pointed to certain secular customs in the people that proved to them this specialness about Russia, this sense of communal social life. And in particular, they pointed to the peasant commune. They noted its regular meetings of peasants to decide important common issues about landholding and land use and justice in the community, even law. Now, in part, you can see all of these ideas represent what might be described as a conservative ideology. What they most admired in Russia, what was most traditional. In their view, was most traditional about Russia. In other words, the Slavophile ideal lay backward in history, not ahead. But in doing this, in a strange way, the Slavophiles were also radicals, or some would say utopians. They were critical of the status quo. They dreamed of a new society. They believed very deeply that the cultural features that made Russia great, and made Russia Russian, for that matter, had been steadily eroded by the autocracy since Peter the Great, by the Petrine autocracy, it was often said. Beginning with Peter, who they saw as Russia's evil genius, the state had polluted Russia's spiritual specialness, its spiritual and moral community, with the philosophical errors of the West, with rationalism, with secularism, with, most importantly, compulsion. In other words, unity, order was not natural, it was forced by the autocratic state on people. And the only salvation, they said, was to return to Russia's true natural roots, religious, collectivist, and free. Of course, this was a rather idealistic, and in fact, one should say, partly imaginary image of what the Russian past was like before Peter the Great. But like many mythic histories about the past, it helped inspire their thoughts about the present, a very critical thought about the present and the future. In fact, concretely, these arguments led to a no less idealistic and visionary image of where Russia should go. Practically, these ideas led them not to be conservatives politically, but led them to oppose almost everything about the existing political and social order in Russia, hence why they are truly members of the intelligentsia. They opposed serfdom, Serfdom didn't represent the natural community of peasants. It was imposed upon them. It took away their freedom. As one remembers from rebellions like Pugachev, peasants thought so too. They decried the lack of civil rights in Russia. They declared that it's absolutely essential that freedom exists for the life of the spirit, as they put it. They opposed the death penalty, widely used in Russia, as violating the sacredness of life, as well as, of course, taking away people's freedom in the most dramatic way. They even opposed government's excessive intrusion into private life, into cultural life, something that was so characteristic of the time of Nicholas I. They believed that society should exist as a free community, as a civic community, holding together by natural means, which they deeply believed were possible. In other words, in a lot of ways, the Slavophiles were not conservatives at all. They were rather visionaries, even radicals, one might say, who found a better future for Russia in an imaginary, at least largely imagined, past. Next time, we look at intellectuals who saw Russia's future, above all, in continuing and perfecting the reforms, the westernizing moves of Peter the Great. And these were, of course, the westernizers.
Lecture 12, Westernizers, Bessarion Belinsky.
In this lecture, I'm continuing my discussion of the emergence of the intelligentsia in Russia, such an important group that had so much an influence in later years on how Russians thought about their country and its fate. This time, I continue this by focusing on the Westernizers, so-called Westernizers, which was, by the way, the larger of the two main movements of Westernizers and Slavophiles, who I talked about last time. In many ways, the Westernizers are actually more difficult to talk about. The Slavophiles formed a relatively coherent intellectual trend, partly because there weren't as many of them. The Westernizers, by contrast, were much more diffuse and more varied. What really united them and provoked their attacks on the Slavophiles was their belief, shared, by the way, with Chedayev increasingly, that Russia's only hope, that its only future, lay in fully joining the developed civilization of the West. But they had many different approaches to thinking about how to do that and what the West meant to them. Rather than try to generalize about their ideas or to describe them all and all the variety individually, I want to focus on a single individual primarily, a truly remarkable man who exemplified in so many ways the emerging intelligentsia as a whole, and especially the Westernizers in his sensibilities and his ideas, and above all in how influential he would become in later years as in some ways the most characteristic Westernizer. And this was a man named Vissarion Belinsky, who lived from 1811 to 1848. He died quite young. Socially, Belinsky's interesting because he's unlike most of the other radicals of the 1830s and 1840s, most of the other intelligentsia. He's not the wealthy son of a gentry, but the son of a modest country doctor, a sign of how much society is changing, that young men like this could also receive enough education to join this intelligentsia. Later, in fact, many young intelligentsia would come from this so-called group of what they called in Russian, raznochinsi, literally people from various ranks, not, in other words, from the traditional estates of peasants and nobles and clergy, but really emerging in many ways from this growing middle class in Russia. And this origin, to some degree, may have mattered. It made Belinsky and others like him, in a certain sense, sociologically alien from his society, having no place in its traditional order, and therefore perhaps more likely to imagine a society in which they did have a place, where the middle class had a place. Now, these sort of determinations, social determinations, are, I think, important in the history of the intelligentsia, but perhaps even more important were personal, psychological influences. And this was very important in Belinsky's case. In fact, in many ways, as I think you'll see, it was his disposition, it was his style that made him so interesting, so compelling to so many, and I think to us as well. Now, the fact that he was underprivileged had, among other effects, an important one in that he was in some ways less prepared intellectually than other members of the intelligentsia. His intellectual skills were less finely developed. Unlike most others who came from the nobility, who had excellent tutors at home and then went off to university, he didn't have this, and one of the results was that he didn't know foreign languages. In particular, he couldn't read German except in a halting sort of way. He had to have translations, which his fellow intelligenti were happy to provide. His higher education was also weaker than the others. Though he was able to get into Moscow University, he was expelled after 3 years for being a bit of a troublesome student for his political activism. But Belinsky characteristically made up for this lack of very sophisticated intellectual training, such as his other fellow intelligenti had, with emotional commitment and fervor. And in many ways, this became the essence of his intellectual style. He says, "For me, to think, to feel, to understand, and to suffer are one and the same thing." In many ways, though the particular reasons for this in Belinsky's case are partly social, one sees this in the life of almost all the Westernizer intelligentsia, all the Westernizer intelligenti. Notably, one sees this in his friend and this well-known intelligent we've talked about briefly before, Alexander Herzen. We've already seen last time Herzen's emotional reaction to the church ceremony in 1826, marking the execution of the Decembrists. Another moment occurred slightly later and was again characteristic. Young Herzen and a very close friend of his were walking along the Sparrow Hills on the northern outskirts of Moscow. And the cupolas glittered over the city of many churches, and a fresh breeze, he tells us, shook the leaves. And suddenly, with tears in their eyes, these two young men embraced and swore to sacrifice their lives to the struggle against injustice and evil. Here, too, thinking and feeling and suffering were all of a piece, characteristic of intelligenti, in particular of Belinsky. This is also, of course, very true to the whole romantic ideal, to the ideal that true understanding comes from not mere thinking, not mere reason, but from deep intuitive insight, from feeling, suffering, something the Slavophiles understood as well. And this combination of thinking and feeling pervaded Belinsky's life. Like other intelligenti, Belinsky was serious about everything. He was absolutely determined to refuse to separate private, ordinary trifles of life from the idea of ideas, from the world and life of ideas. Which meant, among other things, that if you happened to be visiting with Belinsky or invited him over for something to eat, when many people did, knowing that his personal life was much more modest and he couldn't afford to indulge people the way others could indulge him, it turns out that as a result he was sometimes a rather poor guest. A story is told to illustrate this, also told by Alexander Herzen, whose memoir, called, by the way, Past in Thoughts, is the source of so much of what we know about the lives of the intelligentsia. One day, it was said, Belinsky was invited to dine with some friends during a Holy Week, during Easter week, and he noticed that Lenten dishes were being served. And he says to the host, "Since when have you become so devout?" Remember, most of these intelligenti were rather critical of traditional religion. And the answer was, "Oh, don't worry, Vissarion, it's not for us. But you know, what would our servants think if we didn't eat Lenten dishes?" Belinsky was outraged, stood up, knocked his chair back. This is the man who hates hypocrisy. And he declares, "The servants? Where are your servants? I'm going right now to tell them that they've been tricked." And you imagine yourselves to be free-minded. You're in the same boat with the czars and the priests and the slave owners. Goodbye. I eat no Lenten fare for instructive purposes. And he walks out. He was never light-hearted, although one should say he did occasionally get extremely drunk. These were not ascetic individuals, but nonetheless serious nonetheless. And at all times, even when drunk, he was unrelenting in his search for truth. Another story to illustrate this, this time told by the famous writer Ivan Turgenev. Belinsky at this point was struggling, as many of his fellows were, with God, the question of God's existence. And Turgenev happened to be meeting with Belinsky at the time, and they were talking about it and in general enjoying this interesting argument about whether God existed. And Belinsky refused to talk about anything else. I mean, for days and days and days, it was his only subject, and people said he was practically in a fever over this question. And Turgenev joined in. And here are Turgenev's recollections. "I was frankly affected by his sincerity and enthusiasm and carried away by the importance of the subject. But after spending 2 or 3 hours in conversation, I began to tire. The lightheartedness of youth took the upper hand. I thought of a walk or dinner. But Belinsky would not stop. There was no lightheartedness of youth with him. And he responded to Turgenev bitterly and in earnest, according to the recollection. He said, 'We have not solved the existence of God, and you want to eat.'" It's important to pay attention to this style, this manner, however bizarre it might seem to us, however exaggerated and dramatic it might seem. And it's important to pay attention to it not only to understand Belinsky personally, but to understand a key aspect of the culture of this whole intelligentsia that would last for generations beyond. And another story illustrates this and how widespread it was and its characteristic. In this case, Herzen tells how he's visiting a friend of his, Vadim Pasek, not a very significant man, a Polish man interested in Polish liberation. They were enjoying a glass of Rhine wine when, Herzen recalls, Vadim became more and more gloomy. And suddenly, with tears in his eyes, he repeated the words of Don Carlos, which is from a play by Schiller, who was quoting them from Julius Caesar, 23 years old, and still I've done nothing for eternity. And with emphasis, he smashes his hand down on the wine glass, breaking it, cutting himself, and bleeding on the table. This is rather typical of living out, in some ways, a dramatic life from books, from ideas, from the whole spirit of the romanticism. But the point here was serious. The goal of all of these young intelligenti was to serve some higher goal in life, contribute to eternity, as he said. And Belinsky shared in this sort of passion, this search for purpose. Now, all of this passion was dedicated to ideas. So what were these ideas for Belinsky? According to Belinsky himself, in a letter he wrote just before his death, his ideas passed through 3 main stages. His words, "God was my first thought, humanity my second, and man, the individual that is, my third and final." One need only add that each stage was logically, or perhaps better to say, intuitively connected to the next. Let's follow this path with him. I already mentioned Belinsky's struggle with theodicy, with this eternal question of the existence of evil in a world supposedly created by God, who by definition is good, this problem of theodicy. Belinsky's solution, an argument, by the way, increasingly common to many 19th century Russian and European thinkers, was, well, obviously, there can be no God since evil is so palpable. And indeed, this sort of atheism was becoming increasingly widespread in the Russian intelligentsia. His second major intellectual struggle was connected to this first problem, but with a less easy solution. How do you explain evil at all? How do you explain human evil in the world? Now, you remember that like other educated Russians of the 1830s, Belinsky was enamored with German idealistic philosophy, especially Schelling and Hegel. He had to read it in translation, but nonetheless, that didn't stop the intensity of his embrace of these ideas. And as we've seen, these works, especially Schelling, taught that everything that exists in the world is a manifestation of the absolute, of the spirit that connects everything. In other words, that everything that exists in the world, every individual thing, is an embodiment of the totality of all things. It's part of a higher harmony. If so, sort of like the problem with, if God exists, how, if everything is connected and part of a totality, can so much obvious evil exist in the world? So much that was so contrary to one's liberal, enlightened ideals. And Belinsky concluded, because he had to find an answer to this question, and many others around him came to the same conclusion. He concluded that the only correct philosophical response to all of this evil was to say, all is as it should be. And reading Hegel seemed to really convince him of this. Hegel at one point wrote in one of his famous works that all that is real is rational. And now whether Hegel himself actually meant to try to provide in this phrase philosophical justification to everything that exists, to the status quo in the world, is controversial. In fact, I should mention that Hegel also identified struggle against evil, conflict, as at the very essence of reality. But whatever Hegel's actual view, what really mattered is how Belinsky and others around him read this phrase, all that is real is rational. This was in 1839, 1840, when these discussions were going on, and Belinsky, like many others in his circle, read this in a conservative way. Here he seemed to find a solution to this terrible clash between ideals and reality. The answer? Reconcile yourself with reality. Reconcile yourself even to evil. And he actually described this enlightenment, if that's what it is, in a letter. He says, quote, I now look upon reality, which I used to hold in such contempt, and I tremble with mystic joy, recognizing its rationality, realizing that nothing in it may be rejected, nothing could be condemned or spurned. Now, he didn't deny that evil existed in the world. On the contrary, he continued to speak of it, mainly in letters and in conversations, and he even spoke of the evil of the world as disgusting and vile and ugly and dead and oppressive. But now, he said, I can accept this world. Or at least, he tried to convince himself philosophically that he should. This lasted about a year. And about that point, Belinsky found this whole argument to be totally unbearable. Now, it's revealing that Belinsky managed to escape from this reconciliation with reality, as it was often called at the time, not by better logic, not by reading Hegel more carefully and understanding him more deeply, not by reinterpreting Hegel the way, for example, the young Karl Marx would do in Germany at the time, in a whole group of young Hegelians who read a radical implication in all of Hegel. No, Belinsky's solution was by trusting his deeper instincts. In other words, by turning to his moral feeling rather than pure philosophical rationalism. And I should say this was more than just a matter of feeling, though that's very central for Belinsky. It was also connected to a rediscovery and a reemphasis on a central philosophical, really ethical idea, one that was becoming central to the whole emerging thought of the intelligentsia, at least the westernizer intelligentsia. And this was not God, not the absolute, not humanity in the abstract, but that final point that Belinsky said was central to the evolution of his thought, namely the individual human being, man. In fact, we here encounter another key cultural word, a Russian word worth knowing. You'll hear it again later. And this is the word lichnost, lichnost. This is the individual person. It means also, though, the human personality. It means the self in a certain way. It's what makes people human, what's inside every person that makes them human, and what gives them dignity as a human being and natural rights. In a lot of ways, you saw this idea of the human personality giving people dignity and rights, this idea of lichnost, in the writing of early and the thinking of early intellectuals, Novikov, for example, especially his essay on human dignity, the Decembrists, and many others, even young Alexander I. It was so much a part of his education, so much a part of the Enlightenment. But now, in the 1830s and 40s, this was much more passionate, much more intense. And with this idea in mind, this idea of the personality and the rights and dignity that go with it, this idea of lichnost, Belinsky was able to face the world around him truly armed to do battle.